of the Board of Lectureship of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientists in Boston, Massachusetts. Mr. Alton spent many years in business in the United States and abroad and served as personnel director of Rockefeller Center. In 1957, he entered the full-time practice of Christian Science in New York City. He became a Christian Science teacher in 1961 and in 1963 a Christian Science lecturer. After devoting 7 years to the lecture work, he was called to serve as executive administrator of the Mother Church, returning to the Christian Science Board of Lectureship in 1973. The title of Mr. Alton's lecture is How to Love and Be Loved. I am happy to present Mr. Alton.
Thank you so much, Miss Hansen. And a very good afternoon to all of you. I'm so happy to be able to lecture in this lovely church and here in San Francisco, and I think particularly on this subject of how to love and be loved. Because certainly in our large cities, love seems to be particularly needed. There are those who are alone. There are the people that seem to be forsaken by the world. There's the crime in our city streets. Conflict is undermining the family unit. I saw some statistics on divorce not long ago which showed that, for example, in Sweden, 60% of the marriages there end in divorce. And in several of the states of our country, over 50% of the marriages end in divorce, and it seems to be going up. But probably worst of all is the conflict, the loneliness, the abandon in the hearts of each one of us. And all this conflict is like having termites in a wooden house. It undermines and it destroys wherever it's found. But where does all this conflict come from? Isn't the answer really a simple one? Doesn't it begin in the hearts of each one of us with individual conflict? Hundreds and thousands and millions, and today even billions of these individual conflicts pile up one on top of another into nationwide and worldwide smoldering and violence. The big question is, what can you and I do about removing all this conflict? And what's the most effective way to go about it? This afternoon, I'd like to propose the answer in just two words. Brotherly love. Hackneyed? Yes, I know. But when examined carefully, deeply scientific. Think for a moment. What would happen if everyone in the world would remove his own conflict, his dislike, his criticism, his prejudice, his mortal struggle, and would replace it with love for himself and for everyone else? And if he would go about this with the quiet, orderly thoroughness of one of those scientific workers in his laboratory or at his drawing board. Oversimplification? But isn't truth always simple? The important thing is you and I need to care enough about our brother's well-being to be willing to do something about it and then find out how to love. And how to utilize this love thoroughly, scientifically. Actually, the scientific brotherly love that we're talking about is included in the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or, as the Bible states it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, I know a lot of people question the practicality of the golden rule. In fact, you may remember George Bernard Shaw's comment about it. He said, the golden rule is that there are no golden rules. Well, I propose quite the opposite point of view, that the golden rule has behind it enormous spiritual power, laws, absolutely reliable, unchangeable, scientific laws. And that these laws, when applied intelligently, understandingly, specifically, will bring about enormous changes in human affairs, both for every one of us individually and for our world as a whole. So this afternoon, I'd like to talk about that golden rule from a scientific or logical point of view. First, how this rule becomes meaningful and effective in our lives when you and I make a tremendous discovery. When we discover that it's man's spiritual selfhood and not this physicality that you and I are being called upon to love. Second, I'd like to talk about how we can begin to love ourselves correctly. Third, how we can love our neighbors, friends, enemies alike, scientifically. And finally, I'd like to talk about the practical aspects of the golden rule. What happens to conflict in ourselves and in our world when we really learn how to love? Did you know that every major religion in the world teaches the equivalent of the golden rule? Not only Christianity, but Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism. Jesus, the master Christian, certainly taught that the supreme power of this universe, the all-pervading power, is good, is love. And yet, why is there so little love among mankind, one for another? The answer is evident. People have lost sight of basic spiritual truths. Religions in general have forgotten what some of their founders certainly must have glimpsed. Christians specifically have overlooked what Jesus taught about man. Jesus taught that man is always lovable because his true selfhood, though unseen by the physical senses, is spiritual and perfect. And it's this spiritual and perfect selfhood of every one of us that the golden rule is talking about. It's not talking about a perishable, material mortal with ugly or distasteful qualities. So, to obey the golden rule, you and I need to at least glimpse one another's spiritual selfhood. Otherwise, those troublemaking, those unlovable characteristics which underlie all this worldwide strife. Is such a radical change in our concept of man possible? It certainly is. And what's more, it's workable, it's provable, because it not only removes our own conflict, but it helps to free others of their undesirable traits at the same time. Now, this is a scientific or provable aspect of that golden rule which Christian Science introduces. And when it's consistently applied on the basis of these spiritual facts, this law, this wonderful truth that underlies it, profound and far-reaching changes take place. How then can we go about better understanding this perfect spiritual man? How can we become more aware of his spiritual selfhood of every individual? The Bible is helpful. In the very first chapter of the very first book in the Bible, Genesis, we find a direction. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." And then the Bible consistently acknowledges God to be spirit. Well, then, isn't this saying then that this man made in God's image, in God's likeness, must be spirit-like, God-like, not matter-like? Now, if this were a blackboard up here and I wrote a number 3 or 4 or some figure, there's nothing in that 3 or 4. It is simply a reminder, a hint, of a mathematical truth that is found everywhere. And so, when we look at a mortal, or look at ourselves, what we've got to begin to see is that isn't the essence of ourselves. The essence of ourselves is the very expression of God. As the Bible said, God's offspring, sons and daughters, not in terms of physicality, but in terms of our real being, our real essence, which is forever one with God, forever inseparable, forever existing. Now, Jesus saw through all of this. He claimed his true selfhood to be spiritual. He said it a number of times in a number of ways. Let me just read you one of them. Yeah. Jesus said, "I am from above. I am not of this world." Jesus acknowledged spirit to be the primal cause, the source of his intelligence, his love, his very being. To Christian Scientists, his title of Christ Jesus, or Jesus the Christ, simply means that he lived this Christ or spiritual selfhood, lived it so consistently in his daily life that name of that spiritual identity, the Christ, and the human Jesus are forever linked together. Now, he didn't stop there. He urged his followers, those who follow him in the understanding of these tremendous spiritual truths, this principle of being, he urged his followers to do as he did, to claim as their true selfhood their spiritual identity, and to disassociate themselves from just physicality. Let me read you one or two things he told his followers. Here's one. He said, "Call no man your father upon the earth." Why not? He said, "For one is your father, which is in heaven." Claim your spiritual identity. And then Jesus was practical. He followed it up with this statement. He said, "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your father, which is in heaven, is perfect." Certainly a cause which is spirit and perfect must have an offspring, an effect, which is exactly like the cause, spiritual and perfect too. Physical mortals are destructible. What a far cry they are from this ideal spiritual man. This perfect creation of God's spiritual universe of divine ideas. Someone might say, how does this understanding of spiritual man remove conflict? Well, this understanding of spiritual man is like having a windowpane, which allows goodness and love to come into human consciousness. This understanding enables you and me to see that what man really consists of are the true man, the spiritual man, are the spiritual qualities which he expresses. Intelligence, goodness, joy, even though they're not humanly apparent. Golden rule, and someone might say, well, but what about all those unlikable characters who express no divine qualities? Now, how are you going to love them? Well, here's where the science of the golden rule comes into operation. We can still focus our thought on what God's expression, spiritual man, is like, and know that these qualities are true and present, even though not humanly apparent. The golden rule demands that we love, that we look through the mists of material selfhood and latch onto the spiritual nature, identity of every individual. When we do this, we're being loving, and conflict begins to fade out. Now, what we're talking about is not visionary, it's not theoretical, it's not philosophic, it's practical. And we, Mrs. Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, stresses that proof, that demonstration of this fundamental principle is the key for every one of us. Let me give you an example of how this goes to work scientifically. A man who I'd worked with in business dropped by my office after I'd become a Christian Science practitioner, and he was very disturbed. He said that he and his wife were finished. He'd been putting up with her pettiness and her nagging for many years, but now that their daughter was old enough to support herself, he was leaving home. He'd had enough. Well, I might add that his wife could well have considered him as no bargain either. He was opinionated, stubborn, domineering. You know the kind. Well, I could see he was too wound up to have me start telling him about his wife's divine nature and perfection. But as a Christian Science practitioner, I had an obligation to clean up my own thinking about all this problem that he had brought into my office. So after he left, I mentally denied that these objectionable traits had any place in God's spiritual universe of divine ideas. I mentally and spiritually affirmed that goodness, love, understanding, unity were the divine facts about this couple. I reasoned that because God, the divine mind, is the source of all true intelligence, that these two, in truth, were one with mind, and therefore one with each other, untouched by animosity or fault finding. I continue this kind of spiritual realization, of spiritual declaration and awareness of the truth of these facts until I saw clearly that these were the truth. In other words, I applied that golden rule scientifically. A few days later, my friend telephoned. He said he simply couldn't believe the change had taken place in his wife. What an effort she'd made to correct her faults, said he. And then he spoke of her tenderness and her kindness. Had his wife changed? Not really. Only his darkened concepts of her had lessened, revealing more of her true spiritual nature. Certainly a sunrise which dissolves the darkness of night doesn't alter the landscape. No, the light only enables us to see what was always there. So then, the Golden Rule demands that you and I hold to this spiritual man as our model. When we do this, we're being loving, and conflict begins to disappear. The Golden Rule tells us that our loving, our holding to this spiritual man must begin with ourselves. Why? Well, first of all, Jesus' commandment said, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, how can you love your neighbor as yourself unless you love yourself first? And the trouble with almost all of this is we don't like ourselves very much. And we treat our neighbor about the same way. And then, most of us have been educated to believe it's wrong to love yourself. We say this is pride, ego, self-centeredness. And the Bible speaks about the wrongness of those. Now, how do we reconcile loving yourself and at the same time not being egotistical? We do it by not loving our physicality, because that certainly is ego, selfishness, self-centeredness. But we begin to love God. And then we see that our true selfhood is God's perfect spiritual expression. God expressing himself. It is a wonderful identity. Then we begin to see that is what is true about ourselves. And then we begin to claim the spiritual qualities that are true of God and true of man, made in God's likeness. Reflected talent of every kind, intelligence, joy, even though they're not humanly apparent. Also, to be consistent, we've got to begin to unload those ungodlike, those evil qualities which seem to relate to materiality and physicality. Because if we're going to love our spiritual identity, see it, then we've got to begin to unsee this physicality. Because that is the Adam concept, that is the shadow, that isn't the essence. So when we begin to claim the spiritual and get rid of the materialistic, then wonderful things begin to happen. We begin to love and be loved in a right way. I'd like to tell you about a young friend of mine just out of college. And what happened to him when he discovered what it meant to really love himself. After graduation, he went to work for a large, one of these big corporations. But very quickly discovered that his talents weren't being recognized or utilized. He became very depressed, despondent, disturbed. And he began to turn to heavy drinking and late nights for compensation. Illnesses developed, a bad case of ulcers, varicose veins. He was a very disturbed young man. About this time, someone, seeing his difficulty, gave him some Christian Science literature and urged him to visit a Christian Science practitioner, which was without doubt the last thing in the world he wanted to do. But he was desperate, any port in the storm. The practitioner explained that what he was really suffering from was an identity crisis, that he was looking for his true selfhood in matter instead of in spirit, in God. She pointed out that man made in God's likeness expresses, reflects every spiritual quality, usefulness, talent, brilliance, joy, happiness, health. He'd been identifying only with physical qualities and limited capacities, and he obviously was reaping exactly what he'd sown. But he also discovered that what he was reading and hearing was logical to him. It made sense. And gradually, he learned to reason out from a spiritual premise and to come up with spiritual conclusions. For example, he realized that he saw that he is the expression of the divine mind, reflected the inspiration to hear this mind's wonderful answers to business problems, judgment to determine right from wrong solutions, courage to trust this mind's intuitions, inspirations to be correct. In a period of about 3 weeks, with the practitioner's help, the ulcers and the varicose veins were totally healed. And within a matter of weeks, or rather months, a whole turnabout had begun to take place in this young man's life. He began to move ahead in that large corporation and to be respected by those older men for his sound approach in solving business problems. Here was practical evidence of what happens in our lives when we learn to love ourselves, not physicality, but to love ourselves as God's perfect spiritual expression. Now, I can vouch for this healing because I was a young fellow. So much for loving ourselves. But the golden rule tells us we must love our neighbor as ourselves. Now, how do we go about this spiritually scientific loving? Well, perhaps first we ought to discuss a little bit why it's important to love our neighbor. Certainly without brotherly love, conflict at every level, every phase of human experience is inevitable. And since that gasoline shortage a few years ago, at least that crunch, we still have short. Since then, we've discovered that this planet of ours has shrunk so fast that everyone's interests are inseparable from everyone else's. So there's a new urgency to solving problems which result from our responding to what we think our neighbor to be. To love our neighbor as ourselves means we cannot believe or accept other people's faults. Because if we declare we're spiritual and perfect, mustn't we see our brother as spiritual and perfect too? Because it is a spiritual fact. We are all brothers and sisters. Doesn't that Bible tell us? Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? This need for a higher, broader view of our neighbor was illustrated by Albert Schweitzer, the famous theologian and humanitarian. In one of his books, he tells of tribesmen for whom brotherly love meant only blood relations and members of their own tribe. If one of these tribesmen was asked to perform some simple service for someone outside his family or outside his tribe, nothing could persuade him to do it. He would refuse with complete innocency. But this man is not brother to me. What effect does such a limited concept of brotherhood have? Why, it means unsatisfactory human relations, limited usefulness, limited rewards. And yet, how many of us are tribal in our love? Is our love confined mainly to members of our own family and those with whom we're closely associated? Are we limited in what we see about the truth of one another? Are we so cut off from the mainstream of man's identity that we don't even try to understand the other person's point of view, those of other generations or races or nationalities or religions? If so, we're contributing very little to world peace and therefore to our own best interests. How then can we do a better job of loving our brother? Well, even from a human point of view, we can try to find that which unites us with others, what we have in common with each other, rather than to magnify our differences. Mary Baker Eddy stresses this in the area of religion when she points out that all Christian churches have a wonderful point in common: the Lord's Prayer. Certainly in this time of Mideast difficulty, Jews and Muslims and Christians can come closer together because they all share the same basic truth of monotheism, of one God. And of course, the need is simply to learn that this one God is love, and that they all are in truth brothers and sisters, ideas held in the arms of love. Mrs. Eddy felt so strongly the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God. She saw a tremendous spiritual truth. It's a tremendous truth, and it's this. She saw that that it's only through spiritual love, it's only through God love, that all conflict can be removed. Human love won't do it. I ask you, can you love one of these muggers? Can you love a kidnapper? It's impossible to love them humanly. But when we love spiritually, we will reach through, break through that mental straitjacket of darkness that has our brother incarcerated, get a hold of his spiritual identity, bring it into our consciousness, see it for what it is, the image and likeness of God. This other is simply mirage. It's simply shadow. It's untrue. And when we do that, we'll not only find ourselves loving everyone, not entertaining hate or anger or prejudice or resentment, but we will be loving all. And furthermore, we will heal. How else are we going to free these poor individuals? When Mrs. Eddy discovered for herself over 100 years ago this fundamental spiritual principle of being, of a perfect God that is everywhere, and man made in God's likeness as the spiritual fact about everyone, she had fully expected other Christian churches to include this healing truth in their churches. When they didn't, she founded a church built on that science of love, the science that reveals man's spiritual perfection as the image and likeness of God. Since then, well over 3,000 branches of this church have been formed and can be found in most parts of the world. Mrs. Eddy lived love in her life. And as leader of the Christian Science Church, she urges every one of her followers to be an example of love lived in his life. She reminds her followers, she says, a genuine Christian Scientist loves Protestant and Catholic, D.D. and M.D., loves all who love God good, and he loves his enemies. Speaking of living love, certainly in order to do so, we've got to find that which unites us with everyone. There's a story about Albert Einstein and a little girl, which illustrates what happens when we do this. A little girl named Jane lived near Dr. Einstein in Princeton, New Jersey. And on several successive afternoons, Jane failed to go directly home after school was out. Well, her mother quickly investigated and discovered that Jane had been stopping off at Dr. Einstein's home. Well, she quickly called the doctor to apologize for her little girl's taking his valuable time. He replied, "Why, don't think a thing about it. Jane's no bother. We have much in common. She seems to like my help with her arithmetic. And I love her jelly beans." Well, of course, they had more in common than jelly beans and homework. That was an excuse. But they had discovered something in each other that was very meaningful and very important. How essential it is that we find something meaningful and important in every individual. But to go all the way in removing this conflict, to really love our neighbor, we must see his true identity as the image and likeness of God. We must refuse to settle for just the fleshly concept of anyone. In other words, loving our neighbor isn't just one person trying to like another, although that's important. It's recognizing that that word man is really a term for spirit's expression, for all those wonderful qualities that are true of God and true of man made in God's likeness. To love another means we must see only what is spiritually true about him and not settle for what the eye and the ear tell us about anyone. Now, some people would say this is simply closing our eyes to the facts. But aren't we really getting at the facts? The spiritual facts, the all-important facts. But how is seeing my neighbor's spiritual selfhood loving him? Well, let me ask you. If someone sees only perfection as true about you and refuses to accept your faults as any part of your true being, wouldn't you feel loved? Particularly if this kind of love helps to free you from your shortcomings, even heals you physically. This is really love. And incidentally, the one who does the loving is blessed too. Because the good we see in another, we automatically establish about ourselves. Why? Because what we are, our lives, our capabilities, is the objectification of our thinking. And the person who loves spiritually inevitably becomes more loving humanly, too. So unless we are humanly loving, something's wrong with the way we've been reasoning. Doesn't that golden rule indicate we must care for another as we would have him care for us? We must think love and act lovingly. We've been talking about loving our neighbors, but primarily neighborly neighbors. What about all those mean people? What about all those troublemaking nations, our so-called enemies? How are you going to love an enemy? Well, here's where, for many, the golden rule becomes unrealistic. This is like the Sunday school teacher who taught her class of 10-year-olds that they must love their enemies. And then she gave them practical instruction as to how to go about it. And finally, for homework, she asked each one of them to come in next time and tell how he had succeeded in loving an enemy. I recommend it for homework, too. Next Sunday, one little boy, told how he'd made friends with a school bully. A little girl explained how she decided to visit a sick classmate whom no one liked, and they'd quickly become good friends. Teacher finally got around to Johnny, and asked him what success he'd had. After considerable hemming and hawing, he said, "Well, there's some kids on my block who are bigger than me and awful mean. Each day this week, I tried to like them and be nice to them. But every time I tried, they acted meaner and tougher than before. After hearing all you say how you made friends, and I didn't make any, I just figured out what the trouble is. You just don't know any kids as mean as the ones that live on my block." Well, it's pretty tempting for most of us to agree with Johnny and believe our so-called enemies are unique and beyond anyone's ability to love. And yet, take Jesus. Could anyone have had more violent or more vindictive enemies than Jesus? And yet, you remember his advice to every one of us, to his followers? He said, "Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you." Wasn't he saying pray for them by seeing them, not as miserable, vindictive mortals, but seeing them in that true selfhood, that spiritual identity as the image and likeness of God? But why should we love an enemy? Just what's at stake? Everything. Not only does our own health and well-being depend upon loving all, but the very future of this planet of ours lies in the balance. Enemies are the... No. Believing that there are enemies is the cause of inner conflict. It's a basic cause of malignant disease. It's behind all the conflict we talked about earlier, the crime, the industrial strife, the divorce. So giving up enemies is all important. In fact, we have no choice. Just what is an enemy? Well, Johnny certainly thought of them as people, as boys and girls. You and I need to see that enemies are never people. They are evil qualities which cause conflict and which people entertain. Our enemies are hate, prejudice, fear, pride, to mention just a few. And it's entertaining these evil qualities in our consciousness which causes us to fight ourselves, to fight others, that make us sick. How then do we go about loving an enemy? We do it through what we call scientific prayer. Now, I've touched on scientific prayer several times this afternoon. What do we mean by it? Well, if we have a problem in arithmetic, we don't fight the problem, we don't hate the problem, we go back to the truth of mathematics. And we search that truth until we find the specific truth or truths of which the problem is simply ignorance. And when we see that truth understandingly, intelligently, convincingly, that ignorance is gone, the problem solved. And so in scientific prayer, we don't hate the enemy or fight him. We go back to the fundamental principle of all being that's everywhere and exists. It's true about every one of us. We go back to that principle and we search that principle until we find the specific spiritual truth or truths of which the problem is simply ignorance. So, what do? First, we separate the so-called evil from the individual. And then we take each element of that evil and reverse it and find the spiritual fact of which it is simply the lie, the ignorance. Instead of hate, we see love. Instead of evil, we see good. Instead of dishonesty, we see the truth, integrity. Instead of limitation, we see abundance of spirit, of God, of love. And then we hold to these spiritual facts until there is no trace of an evil quality left. Where? In our own consciousness. Finally, we must hold to these spiritual facts no matter what the physical senses are screaming to the contrary. Because when we do, what happens is what Jesus said would happen. So simply, so profoundly, he said, "Ye shall know the truth, and that truth shall make you free." When you see that truth knowingly, understandingly, the power inherent in that truth, in that specific truth, of which the problem is, the hate is simply ignorance. When we see it, that power dissolves that ignorance. We're free. Healing takes place. Now we've touched upon the application of spiritual truths, of prayer, of real love in the dealing with a human relations problem, a physical ailment, a business difficulty. But what about all these so-called big conflicts of the world? The crime, the industrial strife, the divorce. It's such a temptation to believe that little you and me are too insignificant to do anything about it. Well, this is simply ignorance of what the power is. You and I are not the power. The power is infinite, ever-present, divine love, God. And you and I are simply the operators of the power. We put this law into operation in any situation by seeing its presence and its all power, whether the problem seems to be tiny or tremendous. In either instance, in the sight of divine love, it's non-existent. I'd like to give you an example of what just one person did to bring about freedom for many and harmony for many. A large corporation was engaged in labor negotiations with 12 different unions at one time. Under the prevailing conditions, dealing with one union would have been hard. Dealing with 12 unions seemed impossible. The personnel director of this corporation, a Christian Scientist, was asked to help work out an agreement. Now, what would you have done if you'd been in his shoes? Well, this man got down to scientific prayer that we've been talking about. That is, he established for himself the spiritual facts behind this situation, that God, divine love, fills all space. And that each individual related to this case was, in fact, a spiritual idea created by divine love and governed and guided by love. That divine love operates through the law of justice. It never tolerates stinginess on one side or greediness on the other. That God, the divine mind, is the only mind, the mind of all of its ideas. And therefore there can be no truth to many kinds of minds, such as labor minds, union minds, and company minds. That this mind brings all together in perfect harmony, in perfect oneness of purpose. Well, this man asked a Christian Science practitioner to help him with the upcoming meetings, and he continued to pray along these lines. Those negotiations proved to be a quick success for everyone. the company representatives or the union representatives were fair in their demands, and the company representatives were understanding. An agreement was quickly reached which satisfied everyone's need. What had happened? Only two people had prayed. They had insisted that good and that love are supreme everywhere, and that all of God's ideas reflect this love and this goodness. As a result, potential conflict had been averted, and thousands of lives had been touched and benefited. How can we do a better job of loving? We can do a better job by gaining a clearer understanding each day that God is love. That God, love, is the supreme power of the universe and fills all space. That there can't possibly be an opposing power called evil which can somehow infiltrate love's allness. That love is good, and this goodness envelops all, tolerating no evil. That love is peaceful, and being peaceful, there can be no power nor reality to disturbance. We can gain a clear realization that God, love, is our constant companion, our forever friend, in truth, man's only relative. Because what's meaningful in relationships are the spiritual qualities that we all need so much, the tenderness, the care, the comfort. And in fact, these are spiritual qualities which are created by God and inherent in each one of us, because of our relationship to God. They're not personal. Scientific prayer calls upon us to see our true selfhood and that of everyone else as spiritual, as the very witness to love's presence, reflecting all of love's qualities in every way and under every condition, without a single unloving or unlovable quality. Boy, you and I, as love's expression, can no more be cut off from love or be unloved than God, love, can stop loving or lose the object of its love. Don't we need to see that God, love, is forever furnishing each one of us with the love wherewith we love? A steady, ceaseless outpouring of this love. The Bible tells us we love Him because He first loved us. This afternoon, I'd like to suggest a 4-point program for loving more. First, that we start each day, we start the day by acknowledging only the presence of God, divine love. And then we pray until we see the true selfhood of every individual as spiritual, enfolded in this love. Then we need to work at holding to that all through the day. Second, we can search our own consciousness for so-called enemies, then recognize that our only enemies are evil qualities, the pride, the hate, the prejudice, the fear. And then we can reverse each one and replace it with a spiritual quality, which is its opposite, and forever true of God, and forever true of man made in God's likeness. Then we will be loving everyone. Third, we can search for spiritual qualities in everyone, friends, enemies alike, and very especially those of the other generations and races and nationalities and economic status. This is building the bridge. Finally, we can live each day with fresh spiritual truths from the Bible, which will enlarge our understanding of spiritual love and true brotherliness. And of course, followers of Christian Science will also turn to Mrs. Eddy's wonderful textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. How important it is for us to understand the power and the law that underlies that golden rule, and then live it to the full. We're being called upon to put spiritual love number one in our lives, to love ourselves because we're part of love's wonderful plan, and to love the perfect spiritual identity of everyone else. Then we'll not only find ourselves being loved and at peace, but we will bring love and peace to this world of ours. And this, my friends, is how to love and be loved.
You have just heard a Christian Science lecture by William Henry Alton entitled How to Love and Be Loved, brought to you by the members of Second Church of Christ Scientists in San Francisco.